Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. How are you doing this morning? We appreciate you listening to us. And now we conclude our Decade 9/11 series. 10 conversations over the last 2 weeks for the 10th anniversary. And we hope you've enjoyed these conversations with pairs of guests like Pete Hamill and Suketu Mehta, Franklin Foer and Jonathan Safran Foer, our 2x4 segment, Julie Menon and Daisy Kahn, Brooke Gladstone and Fred Kaplan, Paul Goldberger and Milton Glaser, plus our one-on-ones in the series with Tom Kane and Ray Kelly, and the two WNYC radio rookies with the education director of the 9/11 Memorial and Museum. And maybe it's fitting that we conclude today by pairing author, playwright, and New Yorker magazine writer Lawrence Wright, who dove headlong into the world of al-Qaeda after 9/11, with longtime expert on radical Islam Fawaz Jurjess from the London School of Economics. This was planned before today, long before today, but we happen to be entering the anniversary weekend with a fresh report of what officials call a specific and credible, though uncorroborated, threat that attackers, possibly linked to al-Qaeda, might try to blow up bridges or tunnels using truck bombs. They say the information came from sources in the remote parts of Pakistan, where al-Qaeda leaders still have outposts, and that information obtained from the bin Laden compound during the raid that killed him indicated interest in attacking the U.S. around the anniversary. So we welcome New Yorker staff writer Lawrence Wright, author of the play My Trip to al-Qaeda and the Pulitzer Prize-winning book The Looming Tower, al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, just re-released with a new afterword, and Fawaz Jurjess, director of the Middle East Center at the London School of Economics and author of books including his brand new one, The Rise and Fall of al-Qaeda. Welcome back, both of you.
Good to be here, Brian.
Thank you.
Fawaz, considering today's news, not so fast on your book title, The Rise and Fall of al-Qaeda?
No, not at all, Brian. There's a big difference between talking about the durability of terrorism. Terrorism will be with us for many years, as it was in Europe in the 1970s and 80s. And it's another thing to say that al-Qaeda exists as a potent movement. Al-Qaeda no longer exists as a movement, even though terrorism will likely persist for quite a while.
But Lawrence, what do you make of the way this is being described by officials as specific and credible but uncorroborated and coming partly from the remote regions of Pakistan and partly from the raid on bin Laden's compound in the spring, the information? What does all that language really tell us, and what does it tell us about the current state of al-Qaeda leadership in those caves after all these years?
Well, American and Pakistani forces picked up an al-Qaeda operative a couple of days ago, Yunus al-Mauritani, and he may have been the source of some of this this threat information. And we're going to be facing these kinds of threats. We've been threatened and threatened and threatened by al-Qaeda. They have not been able to pull off anything really significant in this country since 9/11. Doesn't mean that they want that they've given up on their efforts. They will continue to try. I don't think that al-Qaeda Central in the tribal areas is able to extend its reach very well.
That's a really important question, because Fawaz, if they're linking this to the remote regions of Pakistan, after 10 years of war there, what's left of al-Qaeda leadership? And I guess more to the point, how much ability do they have to direct possible truck bombings in the United States?
Well, you know, Brian, I mean, I think there are remnants of al-Qaeda Central. I mean, some of them who have survived, the dozens or so, I'm sure they have been busy trying to plot attacks against the United States. So the plotting has not ended. And we have many examples of credible evidence that is al-Qaeda has been persistent despite the catastrophic military setbacks that it has suffered over the last 10 years try to attack the homeland. Remember, Ryan, the homeland is the biggest prize for al-Qaeda. If I were Ayman Zawahiri, if I were some of the lieutenants, I realize all I have to do is to basically succeed in carrying out one attack against the United States, one attack to change the debate and narrative. You and I, if I hope, God forbid, one particular minor attack basically succeeds in the United States, it will change the conversation. Then we'll be talking about the extent of the threat. But the reality is, according to everything that we know, according even President Obama, even his national security advisors, in the last 10 years, despite everything that Al-Qaeda has said repeatedly, Ayman Zawahiri has promised to carry out attacks against the United States, Al-Qaeda has failed to carry out a single successful attack against the United States. Al-Qaeda does not have the capacity, does not have the command and control structure, does not have the field lieutenants, does not have the assets to basically carry out spectacular attacks along the 9/11, even though one of these attacks might, I mean, individual attacks, homegrown radicals and terrorists. The point is, it's okay to talk about the endurance of terrorism. It's okay to talk about the persistence of plots, but let's really talk about what has happened to the movement. The movement itself, Al-Qaeda, as it existed since the 1990s, no longer exists. That is, it has been fractured, it has been militarily defeated, and what remains of Al-Qaeda Central basically are desperate groups basically based in the Pakistani areas, various, you know, in particular on the Afghanistan border in the tribal areas.
Fawaz Rajas, author of The Rise and Fall of Al-Qaeda, Lawrence Wright, author of The Looming Tower, and Larry, in the new edition of The Looming Tower, you tell the story of mentors of bin Laden and a philosopher known as Dr. Fadl, who came to renounce what was being done by bin Laden in the name of Islam along the way in this decade. Can you tell us some of that? Because it was fascinating to me, and it's something that doesn't make the press very much.
Right. Well, Dr. Fadl was the principal propagandist in al-Qaeda. He was an Egyptian, like Zawahiri. They went to medical school together. And he wrote two books that became the sort of principal core of al-Qaeda doctrine to indoctrinate their young recruits. And in these books, he enunciated the policy of takfir, which is the excommunication of another Muslim because they were not adequate in their beliefs. This guy was picked up in Yemen after 2001 and then sent to prison in Egypt, where he wrote another manifesto in which he renounced many of the same doctrines that he had espoused. Now, of course, he's in prison. And Zawahiri made the observation, I wonder if the telex is hooked up to the electric shock machine, you know, that. But this was a very persuasive document. He was talking about how Islam does not permit the killing of indiscriminate civilians. That he even goes to me unexpected that the hijackers of 9/11 had betrayed the contract of hospitality with their hosts by getting visas. He says all of these are you know un-Islamic, and Zawahiri felt threatened enough to write an entire book to try to dispose of it. But you know the truth is, radical Islam is in a period of great introspection. It started with this Dr. Fadl business, but right now, with the Arab Spring, with real social change taking place in the Arab world that has nothing to do with violence and with the al-Qaeda philosophy, these guys are really at a standstill.
Fawaz, does that mean, and I'm sure you agree with what Larry just said, feel free to add to it or tell your own story of Dr. Fadl, but did America win the so-called war of hearts and mind, or was that irrelevant to the fall of al-Qaeda?
You know, Brian, as you know, you and I have been talking about al-Qaeda since the first week of 9/11.
That's correct.
And really, the biggest story is not basically about the dozens or so militants and terrorists of Al-Qaeda Central. The biggest story is the strategic failure of Al-Qaeda to win hearts and minds in the Muslim world. The biggest story and the most fascinating story that myself and Larry and others have been, fascinated is the revolt against Al-Qaeda from within. The biggest story is basically the multiple critiques of al-Qaeda that emerged a year after 9/11. While in the United States, most of us focus on the threat posed by al-Qaeda, al-Qaeda was taken to task by former militants like Dr. Fadl and like dozens of top, disciples and mentors, not just Dr. Fadl. Dr. Fadl just one of the top, leaders of global jihadism. And I think in many ways, not just what the Arab popular revolts have shown, is that al-Qaeda's ideology of jihadism and terrorism does not resonate with, most of Arabs and Muslims. That is, this particular ideology, as some of us have argued since 9/11, basically is a fringe movement. This is not to belittle how dangerous al-Qaeda is. Mm-hmm. But it's one thing, again, Brian, to say that al-Qaeda is dangerous, is a security nuisance. Another is to say that al-Qaeda represents an immediate and strategic threat to the United States. In fact, if I may say that America's response to al-Qaeda and 9/11, and when this chapter is written, this particular chapter will not be written until probably 20 years, it will be seen as one of the most catastrophic strategic blunders in the West's history, not just in America's history, because basically we turned a very terrible, insidious, dangerous episode in international relations into a transformative event. So even though the United States has tactically won against al-Qaeda, it defeated al-Qaeda itself, strategically the United States has lost the war on multiple levels in terms of moral standing, in terms, I call al-Qaeda 9/11 is the $5 trillion project, $5 trillion in indirect costs. Not to mention the decline that the America's response to 9/11 has triggered in the Middle East and throughout the international system.
Larry, how much do you agree with that? Did we take al-Qaeda's bait? Was bin Laden laughing all the way to the Iraq war and Abu Ghraib and Dick Cheney's defense of torture because bin Laden predicted it all from the start?
He could not have imagined that we would make the mistake of wandering into Iraq. And, you know, actually, he never thought of Iraq as being a prosperous ground for al-Qaeda because he knows that it was a preponderantly Shiite country and that it would not be a good place for him to try to wage jihad. But he did.
And al-Qaeda, people don't know this to this day. Al-Qaeda is a predominantly Sunni movement.
Yeah, right. And it has, you know, Shiites are heretics in their point of view. And a lot of the war that was waged, the jihad that was waged in Iraq was primarily Sunni radicals against Shiites. But this was not something that bin Laden could have anticipated. It was a complete gift to him. So that his theory that America was at war with Islam was made real when we went into Iraq. People understood that we had to go into Afghanistan, and that was accepted. But to go in, to not finish the job in Afghanistan, and then to go into Iraq and create two unfunded wars, really has opened up a gushing financial wound, which is what he did anticipate. He didn't expect that he was going to defeat us militarily. But he did expect that we would bleed to death, and that's his goal.
Lawrence Wright, author of The Looming Tower, Fawaz Jurjess, author of The Rise and Fall of Al-Qaeda. And Adam in Yorktown Heights wants to push back on you guys a little bit. Adam, you're on WNYC. Hi.
How you doing, Brian?
Good.
I just wanted to say, you guys had a former CIA analyst on All Things Considered yesterday, and she was adamant about the fact that even though al-Qaeda Central may not be as strong as it was, that as a result of some of our actions, the satellite groups like al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, al-Qaeda in Iraq, and another group is like AQIM or something to that effect, I don't remember the exact name, are stronger than ever, that they're getting more radicalized recruits every day, that they're a younger, more educated group, that they're just as well-funded and just as capable of carrying out attacks as al-Qaeda Central ever was. So it doesn't seem that the problem has really gone away. It's almost like a hydro that we've cut off one head to sprout, you know, five more.
Mm-hmm. Fawaz, what do you think?
Well, the problem has not gone away at all. No one is suggesting that fringe elements and groups that subscribe to al-Qaeda's ideology, like al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Al-Qaeda in Iraq and other Al-Qaeda fragments.
And I'll throw in, Fawaz, let me throw in here that you mentioned in your new book about the connection to homegrown extremism in Western society among small pockets of radicalized Muslims, but perhaps growing here while it's dwindling there.
Absolutely. So there are persistent risks and dangers in many parts of the world. And in particular, I really spend a great deal of my time in my book, The Rise and Fall of Al-Qaeda, on the so-called homegrown radicalism or terrorism. And in fact, and I do establish a causal link between the American war on terror, in particular in the Pakistan-Afghanistan theater and also in Iraq, and basically the increase and the number of young Muslims who basically subscribe to this particular insidious ideology.
But why? And Adam, thank you for starting an important part of this discussion, I think. So what you're saying is even as Al-Qaeda is being pushed toward irrelevance by its own radicalism, pushed toward military death by the United States in most places, and even as the Arab Spring shows that there is little love for Al-Qaeda among Muslims around the Middle East, there is an increase in this homegrown radicalism in the United States and in Europe. How do those things connect?
Very, very much. I mean, that's quite very easily, Brian. I mean, when we say that the overwhelming majority of Arabs and Muslims do not really buy the rubbish that Al-Qaeda tries to throw at them, does not mean that you don't have individuals who still subscribe to this particular ideology. The ideology says that the United States of America and the West are waging a war against Islam and Muslims. And this particular hypothesis gained a great deal of momentum and acceptance in certain circles, in particular after 9/11, and in particular after the expansion of the American war on terror. Iraq really triggered a great deal of radicalism in many parts of the world, including Europe and the United States. And now Pakistan has emerged. Almost every single homegrown, almost every, and I'm choosing my words very, very carefully, Brian, almost every homegrown radical or terrorist now cites Pakistan and Afghanistan as the driver behind his or her radicalization.
That's interesting.
So really what we're talking about here is aftershock. We're talking about legacies. We're talking about really blowback, if I might say.
Yes.
This does not mean that ideology does not really play a part. Ideology, that the ideology of global jihadism, transnational jihadism, resonates among a certain minority groups, among Muslim very tiny groups. So it's okay to talk about the persistence of the terrorist threat and not to belittle its danger and risks to America and the West and Muslim societies. It's another thing to say that the war on terror must continue. We must still wage wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan and other theaters.
We have about 5 minutes left. You two are probably the guests that this show has called on most frequently to talk in depth about Al-Qaeda over the last 10 years. Fawaz, as you pointed out, you made your first appearance on this show right after the attacks. You came on, I think, in early October as well in a live broadcast from Newark and turned a lot of heads. I think we discovered you, actually, but took our understanding to a new level at that time. Larry, with your various works, you've been on a bunch of times. How well do you know? Larry, do you know each other? You seem to know each other.
Mainly through these kinds of shows.
Have you ever had lunch or anything?
No, no, we need to do that.
Can you say how you've been influenced by each other's work or expertise briefly, or do you have any questions for each other? I'm just curious, Lawrence.
Well, Fawaz was one of the very first writers who entered into this from the Arab perspective. And that was very helpful to me. There were so many books that immediately came out after 9/11, and they were reporters' books and they were intelligence books, but they didn't really reflect the Arab perspective. And that was what awakened me to Fawaz's work, and that was really helpful to me.
Fawaz?
Well, you know, I must confess I have a grudge against Larry, Brian, personal one, because I published a book called Journey of the Jihadist, And then his book came immediately after my book or before my book. It really killed my journey of the jihadist. So the huge ego, the academic in me, has never forgiven Larry for basically doing a great deal of my damage to my book.
If we get together 10 years from today, what kind of conversation do you think we would be having about the next 10 years, Larry?
Well, we have a legacy from 9/11 that we have to deal with. And, you know, on the one hand, we have residual terrorism that will continue to be a problem. And I think right now, I think Anwar al-Awlaki, the Yemeni American, is the most dangerous element of al-Qaeda. And we're going to have to deal with him. And he's very influential. He's really the proper heir of bin Laden, not Zawahiri. But there's another thing we're going to have to deal with, which is the security state that we have built up in response to the terrorist threat. And it's so pervasive. It's completely taken over our lives. And there's a strong financial interest now on the part of industry and government to keep that alive. Long after the threat has begun to diminish, we'll still be going through security to get to WYNC. You know, these kinds of things are going to persist. And it's I think, standing in the way of the country that we want to be.
WNYC.
I'm sorry, yes.
Just for the record, and so the FCC doesn't tell us we're identifying ourselves as another radio station. Fawaz, 10 years hence?
Well, you know, Brian, I want to second what Larry has just said, that in my book, in my recent book, The Rise and Fall of Al-Qaeda, I say that the terrorism narrative, the narrative that really gained a great deal of popularity in the United States, has taken basically hold of the American imagination. And that's why I'm terrified, as an American myself, that a single attack in America can revive and can really basically provide ammunition to this particular narrative. Talk about the security-based state, Brian. As you well know, there are almost 1 million, nearly 1 million men and women, basically, that has been built, this particular security apparatus, as a result of 9/11, with high security clearances. 1 million men and women. At the height of its power, Brian, Al-Qaeda never numbered more than 2,000-3,000 militants and extremists. Yet the United States has built a security apparatus of almost 1 million men and women. We have spent, since 9/11, almost, as I said, in direct costs, $3 trillion, indirect costs, $5 trillion. Think of the moral and ethical costs of 9/11, of the opportunity costs. While we in the United States focus on the war on terror, China and other great powers focus on economic renewal.
Yes.
I do hope that when I say that we should really put closure to the war on terror, not in basically putting the threat in its perspective, but also trying to put closure to the security-based apparatus that we have built since 9/11.
Thank you. Larry, as kind of an addendum, you were saying to me off the air before we started that you were wondering about this weekend and all the commemorations that are going to take place. And obviously it's so big in the media and I think in people's minds because it's the 10th.
Right.
Certainly in the family's minds.
Sure it is.
And in the country's minds. But you were asking me, what? Is this going to be the last time we observe the anniversary in this way?
I think, you know, if we are fortunate and we are able to escape future attacks, then we can turn the page on this. With bin Laden's death, I think that that enabled us to take another step. I think the Arab world is eager to move on. You can see the longing to recapture their religion from the grotesque parody that bin Laden made of it. That, you know, I think about the civil rights movement in this country, which was, you know, there's a plaque in Montgomery where there are 40 names, 40 people whose lives were given up to bring this great nonviolent revolution to our country. 840 people died in Cairo in that 17 days. More than 2,200 have died in Syria, and they're not marching into fire hoses and police batons. They're facing helicopter gunships and tanks. In the history of mankind, I don't think there has ever been a more noble sacrifice on the part of nonviolent protesters that continues to this day.
Lawrence Wright, New Yorker staff writer, author of the play My Trip to Al-Qaeda and the Pulitzer Prize-winning book The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, just re-released with a new afterword. And Fawaz Jurjes, director of the Middle East Center at the London School of Economics. You New Yorkers know him because he taught at Sarah Lawrence for most of the last decade. And author of a new book, The Rise and Fall of Al-Qaeda. Thank you both very much for concluding our conversation series.
Thank
it's
you, Brian.
Pleasure.
And listeners, join me Sunday to observe the 10th anniversary of September 11th and connect with other listeners and special guests like Errol Lewis, Pete Hamill, and Leanne Hansen. We will carry excerpts from the ceremony downtown, and we will take your calls with tributes and discussion about how 9/11 changed our lives and how it didn't. It begins at 8:40 Sunday morning. Join me on 93.9 FM, WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and coming up next, a follow-up Friday segment. If you watched the Republican candidates debate the other night, you saw Herman Cain very enthusiastic about how they do Social Security or pension money in Chile. We have the creator of that system to talk about it. Stay with us.